There are liturgical buzzwords. What do they mean? Do they mean nothing? Today, to talk about that is Tim Gordon, my co-host. Tim, welcome back. All right, thanks. So we already did a show. We did post-Vatican II theological buzzwords. And we had some good ones on there. Of course, pastoral. Pastoral was right at the top of the list. People of God, prophetic, social justice, dialogue, springtime of evangelization, new evangelization, all that. We encountered a lot of terms, and we had accompaniment along the way with our faith experience. Mm-hmm. You and I created a faith community during time.
Well, this show is a little bit of a faith community. Yeah. In the winter, the literal winter of evangelization, we're waiting for the springtime of evangelization. Yep. Here in this faith community.
Yes. So those are the words we went over. If you're interested in them, see the previous show where we go through all these cheesy buzzwords that are constantly used in homilies and capital campaigns and stewardship campaigns and even documents. So, all right, today we're talking about liturgy. Yeah. And there's some real doozies in the liturgical world. People use these words to change the theology of the Mass.
Yeah.
Change the theology of liturgy. But I would say almost all of them regard downgrading the place of the priest as a sacrificer. When I was looking at all these terms, I said, basically, we're trying to notch down priests.
Yeah, it's a unifying theme, without a doubt.
Yeah. So probably the number one on this list, Tim, would be presider. What do you think about that term?
A presider is just one who happens to be there. It's almost like it's almost like bystander, which I think they should have gone, you know, full bore and just called him a bystander, an innocent bystander, a con celebrant and his innocent bystander in the church. It really takes away the sacrificer context of the priest.
Right. And, because what if a priest is, in a concentration camp, or what if he's just in a monastery by himself early in the morning celebrating the Mass? There's no one else there, and yet Catholic theology states he is offering the holy sacrifice of Jesus Christ to the Father, the eternal sacrifice, and he's doing it in the communion of all the saints. But he's not. There's no one there over which he is presiding.
No, he's just sacrificing. He's acting in personam Christi for the sacrifice of the Mass. That's not really... I mean, technically, he's presiding over the sacrifice, but that's not the... You might be able to sneak in and remember what Vatican II trickery does, weaponized ambiguity from Vatican II trickery does, people. It takes a denotation of a word, the technical definition. It slips something, it slips a whole bunch of connotation that the really smart, evil people who set this all up knew. Anyone who is a native speaker of English or a native speaker of all the variant languages would really slip and into the context of connotation is what does all the work. It does the stretch work. And it's still technically somewhere on, within the bounds of that denotation. And presider, I think, technically could be defended, like all of this language. Technically, it could, but... In practice, it won't be, kind of like pastoral versus doctrinal. It's the pastoral of overseeing a liturgy.
Yeah. I mean, it is, as you say, technically true. But because of the weaponized ambiguity, you can then haul in a lot of extra meaning. Right.
Which is the whole point.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it notches down the priest. Because it makes him as sort of a presider, like he's a president of a local community, like he's president of the PTA. And so he gets up and does most of the talking, but in reality, he's just there to represent the entire PTA and their needs and their desires. So that beggars the question, okay, well, he's not there this week. Why don't we have Sally do that?
That's true. Which is where they're going now. Right. Right. Unfortunately, or just he's not there this week. Yeah. Same difference. Priesthood of all believers. You know what? Like I've complained before. I revolted. I left, didn't receive communion, obviously, but just bolted out of there. About a year ago, everyone says this has happened to me. The presider at that mass just had his ministers go out, and he chilled on like the throne back there. Yeah. And that's
actually called the presider's chair, to be technical.
The presider's
chair. No, it really is. That's what it's really called.
I know. You reminded me, like, it's so ridiculous. It's not a throne. It's even when he's acting in personam Christi, it's just a chair of a presider.
Yeah.
So it made me enraged. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It paves the way that way.
Isn't it interesting, too, that the presider's chair is always where the tabernacle used to be?
That is, well, it's very, very important iconographically. Yeah, that it's
the tabernacle goes to another room down the hall.
Right.
It's our Lord in time out.
Right. You know?
And then the priest installs his presider's chair
right
where it was.
If that doesn't make all the SSPX and all of the tradies point about, it's now about man, it's not about God, and really, which is what we saw prefigured in the Alta Vendita, that they wanted to make the liturgy about man and not God, that is it's got to be the starkest way to make the point. Yeah. I wanted to also point out all of these, you know, I know religious textbook for teens really well, because I have to look at a lot of most of my garbage. And if anyone ever needs, who's homeschooling and is going through some of these books, by the way, and you know, you want to know what's the wheat, what's the chaff, you can always ask me or text me or hit me on Twitter. I'll tell you the good ones. But most of these books, post-Vatican II, they have to protest too much in a like Shakespearean way. Methinks that us protest too much, because they're like, people, the church is not an organization. It's an organism. It's a living organism. It's like, yeah, I'm cool with that. And obviously that's just the truth, but you're running it like the CEO, these priests and even the Pope are kind of running it like an organization, and we call them president or presider rather than the head, the figurehead. We talked about Ephesians 5 last week in a different show. And it's like, yes, it's not an organization, so don't govern it like one.
Right.
But presider does precisely just that. They do all of the premises of what they say. Oh, we're maintaining tradition. It's an organism. This is part of the tradition of the church. This is part of what the church actually is, denotatively. But they do all the opposites, and they just insist that they're keeping it like good and right minded.
Yeah.
It's a load of hooey.
You know, I've used before on Twitter and other places the term celebrant and celebrate mass. By the way, if you guys like the TNT, T. Marsh, T. Gordon, you guys got to be on Twitter. The party goes on all day long on Twitter with us two and other people with commentary. So you can follow me on Twitter at Taylor R. Marshall. My middle name is Reed. So couldn't get Taylor Marshall. So it's Taylor R. Marshall. There's two R's there. So don't forget that R. And then it's so hard to remember yours. Tim.
Theology. Yeah. Timotheology.
Timothy.
It's got two E's because I couldn't get that one. Timothy Gordon was hard to get. So Timothy.
There is a guy named Timothy Gordon who's people are tagging. It's at Timothy Gordon. He's like, that's not me. Have you seen this guy?
Yeah. He's like, please leave me alone. I don't know what all these papists are contacting me for.
Right. Yeah. So the party goes on.
I'm not even on. I wasn't even on Twitter before November of this year. Basically, when we started the show, I was like, I'm going to get on Twitter now. So I'm not a natural tweeter, people, but it is a lot. It is a lot of fun. And it's sort of like we preside over the organization. Even after the show goes on. So no, it's just fun.
We have a cameo. We got a cameo.
Oh, is it
Maggie's back?
I was hoping it was Maggie. Hi, Maggie.
What, baby?
Blazer's pulling pillows at my face.
Okay, go tell Blazer, don't throw pillows at your face.
That can be dangerous.
Say, Daddy said no pillow fight. So we were talking about, I mentioned something about celebrating Mass, and someone called me out. They're like, that's not really trad, or is that trad? Can you say, like, is that traditional to say the celebrant? Because if you read a lot of the older English texts, it's said Mass. He said Mass.
Yeah.
You know, Edmund Campion said Mass, you know, like that's kind of the older language. And I was pretty sure it was legit because I've seen it in old texts. And just to get everybody cleared up on it, Council of Trent uses celebrants. So
I do like said better. Celebrate does seem like a Vatican II thing.
Well, the problem is low Mass is said, but high Mass is sung. So he didn't really, I don't know, whatever. I'm just defending the term that it's not.
Yeah,
it's not a loaded term like presider. He presided over Mass. No, that assumes that everybody there was offering the Mass and he was just the one who presided over it.
Yeah, no, I got it. A lot of this stuff,
all smoked the peace pipe, but one guy was the presider over the peace pipe smoking.
Right.
That's not how Catholic Mass works. That's not how the Holy Sacrifice works.
Right. But celebrate, you got to admit, so you're right on that one. I didn't even see that person come after you. But you got to admit, it does sound a little bit like a Vatican II thing. Like, come
but
celebrate.
It's not.
There'll be singing. There'll be dancing.
Right.
Yeah, no, it's not.
Yeah, because like you celebrate a birthday party. That's why I think in English we're like, I don't know about that. Celebrate.
There's bad music and bad dancing at a birthday party. Wherever there's bad music and bad dancing, it reminds me of
the Novus Ordo. Yeah. Okay. All right.
The ultimate in bad music and bad dancing.
Exactly.
And bad people.
Easy now. You go to Novus Ordo. You go watch out.
Yeah, no, I make fun of everything that I do.
All right. The next one is worship space. It's not a church. It's not even a sanctuary. It's not a temple of God. It's a worship space, or it's a community.
Yeah, community is big.
So you're talking to your neighbor. Where do you go to church? We go to Good Shepherd Catholic Community.
Oh yeah, that's
huge. Oh wow, yeah. Do y'all have a gym there? Like, y'all have a bingo? Yeah. Actually, you do have bingo. You know, it's like it's the community center.
Yeah, it is. It's
where we gather.
We gather there and we worship.
Send forth. You gather and then you send forth. That's the terms.
We send the young people forth to build houses. And, you know, if you just need to catch a hot sauna with a bunch of old folks who are resting their aching joints, you can do that at the community center, too. Come gather.
Yeah, exactly. And you have all kinds of crafts and things going on. And it's a community center. It's not the temple in which sacrifice is offered to God.
Right.
It's not a cultic building.
Right.
That's the problem. So it's the worship space. It's a space where you worship. You know, my daughters and my wife like to watch these shows where they do like decorating. The real big one is down here in Texas is her name's Joanna Gates. What's the name of that? They're in Waco. You know, I'm glad you don't know. Sorry. Anyway.
Yeah, I have no clue. I'm not a gingerbread kind
of. Anyway, it's a Texas show of decorating. It's the husband and wife. They're really funny. Her name's Joanna Gates. Anyway, I think that's the term word. Anyway, they watch these, and whenever they have designers come in talk about this, they're always like, "This space over here, it really makes this space pop or this space open." I'm like, "Why don't they just say room? It makes this room open up. Why is everything a space?"
That's a good question. For them, why is it? What's the theory?
I don't know. It makes it sound cooler.
But it does. Well, I mean, leftists, and I'm sure they're probably left, like lefties, like they use these neologisms that sound so stilted and fruity. Like I always say that the language, the neologistic language of the left, you get it in television a lot. It's big out here in California, obviously, an hour away from LA here, is like, You talk to people that worked on movie sets little people, costume designers, you know, score composers, people like this you run into. And yeah, they use the terms just because they picked them up, not because they're necessarily fruitcakes. But it's so silly sounding. It's all like the script from M. Night Shyamalan's The Village, where it's like, this sounds so stilted and weird. Just call it a room, dude. Why are you calling like a storage, like a domestic storage space? It's like, wait. Liberals do this.
Yes.
They ruin our mind. They rot out our mind with the language. And there's a reason, but sometimes you can't even tell the reason ostensibly. You're like, I'm going to have to go noodle with that one to figure out why they call this a space.
Yeah.
I'm sick of it. It drives me nuts. Yeah. But sometimes it can be genuinely fun to laugh at them and to just point out how silly that word term is.
Yeah. It's like
in real time.
This is our food storage space. You mean the pantry? Yeah. That's what I meant.
Some call it that. That's right.
But that
and then they'll pretend the normal word is weird. You're like, yes, that's you mean the pantry.
Yeah, right. That's so this whole thing's crept into the church where we have the worship space. And I think the reason that they're doing it in the Catholic Church is the whole campus. You also hear them call it the campus.
Campus. They love that.
Right, the whole campus, which is at least it's a Latin word, means field. Right. So the whole campus is the community center where we gather. But then within the campus, there's this one space that's the worship space.
A small sliver.
Yes. Yeah. Right. But then we also have, you know, the continuing ed buildings and all these other things. Right.
Right.
So that's the worship space. And then you go into the worship space and it doesn't look very worshipful. It's usually white. White is the favorite color of the worship space. And the early liturgists at Vatican II believed that every worship space should have three parts to it. There is the ambo.
Mm-hmm.
There is the altar. And there is the presider's chair. Now, this is really different from real Catholicism, right? In which basically it was just the altar and the tabernacle, the crucifix. It was all lined up. It was completely vertical. If you came into the church, it was very clear that there was a vertical access that pointed straight up to heaven, to God, through the altar, through the relics that were in the altar, through the tabernacle, through the crucifix, right through the dome,
right,
or the tower, which had a cross on it, all the way to heaven. Super simple. It worked for thousands of years. It's great. Right. Love it.
Right. Right.
They said, no, you got the three centers, right? So the ambo is the property of the lay people. That's their, this is how they think of it. I'm not saying this is true. I'm saying this is how the springtime liturgists understand things. The
ambo. LB on you. I'm like, is it really? Is there a bill of sale? Yeah. Sorry, go on.
So the ambo is the property of the lay people. That's where they get to do their jazz.
Got it.
The presider's chair is the property of the priest, of the presider. And then the altar is shared by each group equally.
Hmm.
Okay, so these are the three focal points. And they should never be, there should never be any of them central. So at a church very close to me, when you walk into the church, the ambo and the altar are centered together so that the altar is actually off on the side. Like if you're standing in the center aisle and you're walking forward, the altar is to your left. The ambo is on your right. And I think traditionally the presider chair was in the middle, but it's been moved, thankfully, and they've put a tabernacle in. But it's weird because the tabernacle's in the center, but the altar's off.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So this was the way they thought. Now that everyone, you've heard this, this is what they objectively said in books in the 60s and 50s, 60s, and in the 70s, it all happened. This is how they understand worship space.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no centrality. There's really a triangulation.
Right.
And this also explains why priests often will not use the ambo to preach.
Why? What explains it?
Because the ambo is the lay people's thing.
Oh, because he's in their property or whatever.
Yeah, that's their property.
Oh, yeah. That's where all the ex-nuns going to tell us about the
next
home building center and mission or whatever. Yeah,
right.
Gotcha. No, that's good.
And
so
you'll have lay people come up and read the lessons. Then you'll have the cantor come and do their.
Oh, they do this. They sing some bad thing and then they're like. And you.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Hate it.
So everything goes on there. Right now. Mm-hmm. And then the deacon, he's not a layman, but he reads the gospel there. And then the priest does his thing, but he's at the presider's chair.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to the altar, that's both groups' property. And so ideally that the altar needs to be set up in the architecture so that both groups have equal access to it. And the primary way you do that is have the priest on the other side of the table looking at the people so that it's both people's table.
Right.
Both groups' table, the presider and the lay people. So that's really the reason, that's the academic reason why versus populum mass is so necessary in the Novus Ordo, is that the altar has to be shared by both. It's actually kind of, I never thought of it until now, but it's actually kind of Marxist. Like the priest is the higher one. And so we need to redistribute the liturgical action and bring everybody to on par.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so since the altar belongs to the entire community and he's a presider, he has to face and circle the altar. And then they took it to another level. And they're like, well, why don't we just build our new church in 1979, totally in the round and really, and, you know, circle the altar so that everybody is sharing and participating.
Well, it's this Algonquin idea. Yeah, I mean, it's literally like a round table in the round.
And you sometimes there are round altars, which is crazy. Yeah. Totally
Which
pagan.
Is crazy.
Yeah, it's pagan.
Totally
yeah.
druidic and socialistic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. I don't know. I know a little bit of the where the Phantasmagoria came from on that last part. I don't know where you got all that other stuff. That's good about the ambo and all. That is insightful.
I don't have it written in notes, but I'm pretty sure it comes from Jungmann, the liturgist Jungmann, who was one of the main architects at Vatican II of the liturgy.
You mean Jungmann?
Yeah, Jungmann.
Is the way you...
Yeah.
Is that the German way to say
it? I don't know. We keep the tradition of mispronouncing names on this TNT show episode. So next time you go into a modern Catholic worship space, you don't have to call it a church, call it a worship space. Look, when you get in there, look for the 3 points of focus. Presider's mm-hmm. chair, the table or altar, and the ambo.
Ambo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you'll notice that in the really wild ones, it's completely triangulated. There is no center focus. Sadly, if anything gets the center focus, it's often the presider's chair, which is just crazy.
Well, I feel like that's almost ubiquitous now. I thought that's where you're going with that. The presider's chair, I feel like, is the focus of the visual space. I feel like that's where the eye always goes, and he's just back there chilling in his big like rainbow garment or whatever.
Right.
Well, I mean that's where everyone's kind of just looking. Yep.
And that's why also when the communion is being distributed and you've got the lay Eucharistic minister, sometimes Father Presider will just be like, peace. And he'll go sit in his presider's chair and let the lay people continue the administration of communion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which how many times have you ever seen that, Tim?
Well, that last time that it happened was a year ago.
Right.
When I just left it, you know, bitterly. Not that many times, surprisingly.
I've seen it on college campuses a lot.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that's where I see it. But I mean, I haven't really gone to Novus Ordo Mass that much. I mean, I've been going to Latin Mass for about 10 years, but I really haven't been around it that much in the last 5 to 6 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So
can I tell a quick story that will explicate the presider's chair a little bit better, how central it is. This is something I'm not proud of, but I do defend it by just, again, adverting to the overall badness and boringness of the Novus Ordo. But I'm not proud of this, people. I just thought of it, and it's a true story. It's from sixth grade. I was in your neck of the woods. I was in Plano, Texas, at I won't say which parish, but a big, super in the round, super anti-cruciformic church. You know, just the roundest and the most modern church. One of the most ones I've ever been to. Even the stone in the building's weird. People are in
worship
Plano,
space.
They might
worship space. It just the popped. Worship it just space. The worship space just popped.
It did just pop. That just popped.
Yeah.
Do you feel it? Do you hear? So it was a Mother's Day Mass. And the priest came to me and actually the priest is somewhat well known in the area, but I won't name names. And he said, "Hey, Tim, at the homily," Steph's smiling, "at the homily, I want you to, he gave me a big picture of Mary, and he's like, I'm going to do a homiletics on Mary. I want you to just walk this down to me, because I'm going to be walking in the aisles, you know, that's, you know, amongst the people. They love that. Yeah. And when I get in their worship, up in their grill, their worship space."
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, cool. No problem. And I just had it right next to the presider's chair. And at this parish, that it's just, you're on full display. Yes. That's important to my tale.
Okay.
I'm a skinny sixth grader with braces and, you know, gawky and all that. I'd stayed up super late the night before. Super late, which wasn't a good idea. And this was an early morning mass. This was the 9, which is earlier than we usually went to. And the long and the short of it is, at some point at the beginning of his homily, I did nod off and fall asleep. And literally, all I remember is waking back up and I'm looking around and the whole church is looking at me and the priest is going, Tim, we're waiting on you. Tim. And then I think I might have nodded back to sleep, because it was like a shocked response. But I just remember, maybe I heard it first a couple of times, but I was there. I felt like it was in the center of the world. That's the point of the story.
So did you actually,
it was all around.
Did you actually process the image up?
I had to. Yeah. I ran it down to him. I mean, I must have been, I'm not an easy to embarrass cat as people might be able to imagine, but I was there right next to his presider's chair. And again, there are people like 25 feet away this way, all around, because of the way the thing is built. I couldn't hide my shame for 30 minutes. I just went back to my chair right next to the presider's chair. It felt like being in the center of the room.
I love
like,
it.
Yeah, it was really uncomfortable. But that's how centralized even an altar boy next to the presider's chair is now that they've done this new architecture. It was genuinely embarrassing. Probably the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to me, because I just had to sit there for 30 minutes on full display, elevated. It was horrible.
Yeah. You were scarred.
I was. But hey, don't blame me. It's the Novus Ordo. If I had been at Latin Mass,
that would have never happened.
Even tired.
You know, while we're on the topic of random stories, one of the reasons I don't like the Novus Ordo arrangement, particularly in the round. When Joy and I first became Catholic, our parish was in McLean, Virginia, St. John's. Shout out to everybody at St. John's. And that church it's been more traditional. They've brought in a nice altar and tabernacle, but it's definitely in the round. It looks like a flying saucer. And I was so disappointed, because our Anglican church was just glorious. High altar, ad orientem, wood screen, and altar rails, everything. And this church was just 1950s, 60s, round. The bummer is, you know, we had 4 kids, all little. And so if your kid's crying or fussy or taking off his shoes or whatever, and you want to pick him up and go to the back of the church to just kind of chill him out, you know, not disturb people around you, you go to the back of the church. Over 180 of the church is looking at your face, because it's in the round. So you can never escape and just go to the back of the church for your kid. You are always on display.
I know.
So what do you do? What do all the parents do in the round church? They go outside where it's hot or cold. And now you're with an infant in a worse situation, and you can't hear the mass. You have no idea what's going on. That means the other parent, your wife, has to come and tell you when it's time for communion. It's such a disaster, even for pastoral reasons with families. Whereas at the Latin mass or any traditional church, you can just genuflect with your kid, go to the back, chill. Like, shh.
Right.
And nobody sees you.
Not to mention, culturally speaking, at the Latin Mass, there are many other large families, and the presider, the priest there will be, usually they even say so. The priest I know that does our Latin Mass when we have it is totally friendly. Like, I can talk over crying. And they're trads. So they're used to some noise in the mass. When it's incidental kids crying, they're much friendlier. Conversely, mercy left Novus Ordo priests have told us time and again, or the other big families that get stuck going to the Novus Ordo and don't really like it. Look, when your kids are crying, you need to take them all the way out of the building.
People always talk about, oh, those crowds are mean. And I always say, have you ever been to Latin Mass? And often they say no or once. The only times I have been bawled out, ridiculed, or told what's up was at the Novus Ordo.
Truth.
The only time I've had a priest ever call me names was in a Novus Ordo context. The only time I've ever had an old lady tap me on the shoulder and bawl me in the Mass was Novus Ordo. And the reason for that was my daughter's coat was on the floor.
Oh, yeah. That's a big deal.
You need to teach your kids to keep their clothes off the floor.
Really?
Yes.
It was a constipated old lady that probably didn't have many kids of her own.
I don't know. I'm just like, you're literally interrupting the Mass, interrupting me trying to handle the kids over the coat on the floor. That's the least of my worries on a Sunday morning.
It's a $16 jacket, lady. Like, who cares? Leave it. My kids just have this in like dog do in the back. It's not that valuable.
I know.
What's important is the holy sacrifice of the Mass.
I know.
And she's like, what's that? You mean the service up there in our worship space?
Right. So I'm just saying, you know, the road goes both ways. And I think often, you know, if you grew up in the Novus Ordo in the worship space and that whole thing, you're so habituated to it. Right. That you've never seen anything else. And so often if you go to a traditional Mass, it's disoriented. You're like, what is going on? This is not what I understand as Catholicism. You feel very self-conscious.
You do.
What do I say? When do I kneel? I think it's very easy. And again, the street runs both ways to just say, I reject this.
Yeah.
You have to relearn. It's not necessarily intuitive. It's not necessarily something that would just come to you. It's going to take, I don't know, I think probably going to Latin Mass for 6 months till you've like habituated and you feel normal and natural and you don't have to look at the book. You know,
I said you do like, yeah, that happened to me too. Like I said, no, I don't think anyone in the world, no cradle Catholic in the world grew up hating the Novus Ordo more than me. And wanting something in their heart that's truly reverent. So when I started going to Latin Mass, when I first got married, I started taking my wife Steph, who just converted. Both of us just loved it because we would literally, the songs and stuff, we'd always be filling in joke words at the Novus Ordo songs and just not taking it, you know, just goofing off, chatting,
which is not
getting
good.
Mad. Yeah. Which isn't good. And I knew it wasn't good. And it's like, I want, like we were saying about a king, like give me King Aragorn, you know, I'm not the rogue.
Give us the Tolkien quote. What is it?
There are a couple different ones.
Isn't it? It's the king worth following. Well, how's the quote go?
Oh yeah, that's from The Hobbit. Yes, okay. where Balin says about Thorin. He says, "I looked at him then, and I thought to myself, that is a man that I could follow. That is a man that could be king." Really, he's a dwarf, but he meant like as a male,
right?
So they still call him man. But yeah, I'm not this guy with like we sound like every 3 days a week up here. And probably I sound like this in the rest of my life to my students a lot too. Like, I don't have a problem with authority. Just give me a good priest. Give me a good bishop. Give me a good man. And I will follow him. I will, you know, give me some field command. I'll go do what you want me to do. I'll be your lieutenant. Give me some people to go fight or whatever. Like, and there are, you do run across those guys every once in a while. But I mean, growing up in the Novus Ordo Mass, you don't run across them hardly ever. It's precious, you know, gem when it happens.
Yep.
And I crave that. So my whole point was when Steph and I started going to Latin Mass, we were like, oh, this is amazing. This is like a Catholic Mass. And then you learn about it a little bit the way I did even 12, 11 years ago. And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. This all makes sense. Oh, this is all old. This is really Catholic. So yeah, I did not have that response, but I know a lot of people that I introduced Latin Mass to that were hesitant at first. but then got into it. So that had the response you're describing, which is very, very common for people out there that are tempted to go try it because of all of our railing against the Novus Ordo here on TNT.
Right.
But it's I just loved it immediately. I was like, this is almost like a Catholic thing. It's almost because people go, they're like, this is so ritualistic. It's like, yes, it is. Culty. Yeah,
it's called Catholicism.
Right.
Yeah. Well, before we get to the next one, we got Eucharistic Lay Extraordinary Ministers of Holy Communion. That's coming up. We also got Liturgical Restoration.
Is there like a meaningful order? Because there's one I don't want to get pushed to the A. It's the one I really care about.
What's the one you want to do?
What I really want to make sure people, that I think is the equivalent of whatever we did first last time, is active participation.
Yeah, let's do that. That's actually, so we've done Presider and we've done Worship Space and we've described why the space looks the way it does. And now we have to get to the theology of it, which is active participation.
Which is the first thing that these people, this is the segue, that these people always say when you take them to Latin Mass from the Novus Ordo, they go, but where's the active participation? And you're like, bro, here's the good part. There isn't any, you know, the way you mean it.
Right.
Because
they mean active participation means one of the following: standing in ambo, singing off key with your hand up.
Usually that.
Carrying up the gifts down the center aisle and handing them to the priest.
Mm-hmm.
Administering Holy Communion as a layman and actually touching the Eucharist, which was never allowed.
Mm-hmm.
Except in persecution and extreme cases. I know that people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Singing.
Badly.
Yes.
From the pews. Yeah.
Being an altar server. Being a lector. And otherwise, if none of those things can be done, circling people around the altar.
Or just way too many of the prayers are said in this banal one, monotone voice, just out loud, you know, or even participating in homiletics where the priest will go, amen. And the people go, amen. Like,
yes.
So in the homily, they rap concert.
Or he'll say like, who can tell me, you know, in today's gospel, who is Jesus talking to? And then no one wants to put their hand up. This is so lame. And then like a 9-year-old will be like, me, you know, and he'll be like, who was it, Johnny? And he'll be like, Mary Magdalene. He's like, good job. And then we got to actively. If your hands aren't moving, or your arms not moving, or your lips aren't moving, or your feet aren't walking, you're not actively participating. And that's bad.
Right.
So priests in the old rite, they moved their mouth and moved their hands and moved their feet and did all this stuff, right? Lay people did not. Right? Well, you did make responses in a high mass and you did walk up to the altar rail.
Sure.
But you didn't do any of that physicality stuff. You knelt.
Right.
Right. And so in the 1940s and 50s, they said, you know, we really need we have TV now, we have radio, we have cars, people are out in the world. If we don't give them active participation, we don't give them roles in the play, they're going to leave the church. That was the thinking.
Right.
So what we need to do is we need to incorporate active participation, by which they mean physical participation, of lay people in the sanctuary, in the worship space.
Right.
Or they're going to leave the Catholic Church and they're going to become Protestants or atheists. That was, I mean, I've read some of the documents that actually say that.
Whether or not they believed it, depending on the level of evilness of guy behind the guy, a lot of the middle managers probably actually believe this. The guys writing it, I think, knew exactly how it would play out because they're really smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the active participation. And contrary to that, liturgically, we say to ourselves, well, who was the most active participant ever in worship amongst the human race? Who is that?
The priest.
No, historically. Who is the most active participant in worship of the divine logos made incarnate? The Blessed Virgin Mary. Okay, so that's where you start. Okay, so was Mary at the cross, the crucifixion? Yes. Was she worshiping the divine logos and offering herself even to the extent of mediating through prayers for humanity. Yes. Yeah. Like, we believe that as Catholics, right? That's like the most extreme. Like, she participates in Calvary more than any other human. Like,
that's right.
like Simeon said, a sword shall pierce your heart.
Right.
To Mary. So we believe that Mary was incorporated in the sacrifice of Jesus as a participant, most active as all. But did she say anything at the foot of the cross? No. Did she have a tambourine? Did she bring anything forward? Did she raise her hand? Did she read a lesson?
She did sing "Go Make a Difference," though. If you read the synoptics, that's in there. Yeah.
It's a textual variant.
Yeah, it's a text.
As they placed him in the tomb, she's saying, "Go make a difference." No. So here's the thing. Within the Blessed Virgin Mary's soul, she was the most active participant that has ever been and will ever be in the mystery of Christ amongst the human race. Not as a priest, right? The priest is different because he's in persona Christi. So he's actually entering into the person. He's another Christ. He's in the liturgical action. So he's distinct. But when it comes to lay people, the Blessed Mother is a lay person, even though she's a Theotokos. It is blasphemy. You deserve a slap and a lappa if you say that the Blessed Virgin Mary was not actively participant at the foot of the cross.
Yeah, that's a good rhetorical.
Yeah, you deserve to be taken out if you say that. Her soul was churning prayer and worship for our Lord in the most beautiful way possible. And yet she was quiet. You know, there she is with her mantilla on, kneeling down in the gravel at the foot of the cross. We even call that word co-redemptive, co-redemptrix.
Right.
So if that's the model for worship, why do we need to be having a circus down at the foot of the cross? We don't. That's the answer. Active participation is in the soul. It's not this.
There's an amazing Evelyn Waugh quote on this exact designation. Not Mary, but he says, there is only one who knows whether or not each person in Mass is participating, and he is in heaven. Then he ends the quote with this short one-liner. No need to shout. It's beautiful. No need to shout. Because that, I mean, literally, I had priests growing up at parish schools that would do the amen, and if you're like, this is so gay. This is so lame. Like, I'm not going to say this. They literally would do it again. They're like, oh, I didn't hear you. Amen. And then they try to get people to yell it back. I don't know if you've ever had that. That was very common at some of my parish schools.
I've seen some deacons that like to do that.
Because
the deacons are like, come on, you can do better than that. Let's try it again, everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You can do better than that. Let's pump this jam, bro. And you're like, oh, you're so... All the like preteens, for a mixture of maybe some good impulses and some bad impulses, they don't really want to be there anyway. Yeah. But they wouldn't react that way to the Latin Mass. And I know because I've taken several of my students to the Latin Mass. Like, whoa, that's cool. But the preteens are like, oh, this guy's so lame anyway, which they probably thought going into it. But then when you tell them again, and we're even working at a Catholic school, I refuse with other teachers. Usually it's someone that's not a practicing Catholic will be like, oh, did you see those kids? They weren't singing after the priest asked them to. I was like, you're not Catholic anyway. Like, just leave them alone. I was like, they don't want to sing the lame song. It's not their fault, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but aren't they supposed to actively participate? It's like, then I tell them the Evelyn Waugh quote, like, no need to shout. They might, who are you to judge? As Pope Francis said, maybe they're praying it in their head the way people who really pray do. And the other thing about active participation is, on the note of our last show, it's just a ridiculous neologism. Like, it's like social justice. Participation is always active in the Aristotelian sense, right? Exactly. Active versus potency. It's always active. It's active. You're actively participating if you are like saying your beads, which is what, by the way, that's, I said it before. That's what I do during most Novus Ordo Mass.
I usually get my daily done. When I'm in the Mass, when the offertory starts, the beads come out. And people are often shocked by that. like, even like in public, if I'm, you know, at a conference, like, hey, I heard you pray the rosary at mass. Like, why do you do that? Like, kind of concerned for me, kind of like they found out that I like am addicted to crystal meth or something, you know?
Yeah, no, I know. People
like, they're like, why do you do that? And I was like, well, I mean, isn't it? I was like, would it be okay for you to ask Mary to pray for you while you're at mass? And they're like, yes. And I was like, would it be okay to meditate on maybe Jesus scourged at the pillar or to walk during the consecration to think of him crowned with thorns? And like, well, yeah. And I was like, that's what the rosary is. I'm asking Mary to pray for me, and I'm meditating on scenes from his passion.
That's really bad. That is like crystal meth. Yeah. But then people are like, but old, the council fathers said that the problem with the 1500 year old masses, it was just a bunch of old ladies praying rosaries. And it's like, yeah, I don't see the problem with that, even ostensibly.
I don't see the problem with it at all.
Praying the no, there's no problem with it. But literally, even conservatives, even some conservatives I'm close with out there, you know who you are, that watch the show, will say that to me, like, come on, bro, like, you shouldn't be praying a rosary during Mass, or the old ladies shouldn't have been praying rosaries during Mass. I was like, I beg to differ. We're just going to have to agree to disagree there. It is a perfectly valid place.
Well, remember, they're thinking back to this Novus Ordo worship space where the altar is shared by the priest and the people.
Mm-hmm.
And we're co-offering together.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's presiding, but we're co-offering.
That's right.
I want to say co-author, but co-offer is what I'm trying to say. Co-offering. And yeah. If you're doing a rosary, well, you're kind of like, I don't want to co-offer with the priest right now. And that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I mean, fundamentally, in the Novus Ordo, they want the lay people to be concelebrating with the priest.
It's the priesthood of all believers. It's
and Martin so Luther. If you're pulling the beads out, you're saying, I don't want to concelebrate with the priest right now. I want to think about Jesus carrying the cross for my salvation. And I want Mary to pray for me as I think about this. So I go deeper into that mystery. And right. They're like, well, that's you need to be more like a priest.
Right.
You know,
you're right. You're not wrong. That's and therefore it's this beautiful. And again, this is another part of the reason I like it, not the whole reason I like it. It becomes this act of defiance to whether you have an actual physical rosary beads there or not, which usually I don't at the Novus Ordo sometimes, but not usually. I just start praying my rosary. And half the time, if it's once the consecration begins and we're on the knees, half the time, I don't even get up in between the two kneeling periods during the consecration before and after the host and the chalice are consecrated. And people are like, but this is when we sing the Our Father with our bad voices and hold each other's sweaty hands.
It's concelebration. You know, the other problem is they added at Vatican II, let us proclaim the mystery of faith, which is they were restoring something. They weren't restoring anything. They made it up out of thin air. It's so dumb. Yeah. But what they wanted to do there is like, well, the priest just said, this is my body. This is my blood. And he had a really awesome, like the spotlight was on him. He like got a really cool moment, but that's not fair to everybody else. So let's put the spotlight on everyone else and give them a cool moment. So let's proclaim the mystery of faith. And then we say our part, you know, by your cross and resurrection, you know, like, so we have to, everything has to be balanced.
It does. Or else it's not
fair. It's Marxism. It's liturgical Marxism.
It's calling everything phallocentrist. You're like, this has nothing to do with that. They're like, no, but it is. It's all power centric. It is the fundamental impulse toward, it's a blind Marxist. It's a created impulse, but it's the prejudice of the modern day toward egalitarianism. It has to be balanced because there's nothing that's hierarchical that is palatable. Nothing that is hierarchical can be allowed into civil society or now even the body of Christ.
That's right.
If you ask these non-hierarchical Jacobin hierarchs.
That's right.
And then the real Catholic faith is utterly and I was going to say abjectly, but that would make it sound bad. Utterly and entirely hierarchical. And that's why they had to remake the faith from whole cloth.
Yeah, it is a new theology. And that's one of the things I've really realized over the past couple of years as I've studied it. People will say, well, that's your liturgical preference. You know, there's the extraordinary form and the ordinary form. And it's a buffet. And you just, well, what do you prefer? You know, do you want the fried chicken or do you want the meatloaf? Mm-hmm. You know, and some people like fried chicken and they get that. But the more and more, I mean, you just objectively put the text of the 1970 Missal And then the objective text of the 1962 missal, like columns on a spreadsheet, and just go. Mm. And you realize that things are removed or things are changed to bring about this balance between lay people and priest.
That's it.
And it's not a liturgical preference. It's not about fiddleback chasubles or I like more incense or I prefer the sound of bells or I like this architecture. It's not just aesthetic. It's textual. Mm. It's objective text.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So we got a few more here. How about Eucharistic prayer? So before it was the Roman canon, and canon means a measurement, like canonized saints, canon of the Bible. Like, do you change the canon of the Bible ever, Tim?
No. Not unless you're Martin Luther.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So they no longer call it the Roman canon. It's Eucharistic prayer one. And they changed it. You now have the Mystery of Faith acclamation. And then you can also just, if you want, you can drop the saints' names in Eucharistic Prayer 1. It's an option. They're in brackets.
Bracketed like Ephesians 5. Yeah, it very rare you hear that, though, at a Novus Ordo.
Eucharistic Prayer 1?
One you never hear. And the saints' names, if you do hear one. I've heard one, I think, twice in the last year. Mm-hmm. Church year, which should ring true with everyone out there. I bet you most Novus Ordo people would say they have never heard it. I don't know. That's a good Twitter poll.
Conservative priests I know pray it a lot.
Yes, but even the conservative priests I know who prayed it twice in the last year of Novus Ordo, I've been to Latin Mass some throughout the last year too, but It's still a rarity because I think they get heat for it.
Yeah.
So I don't know what happens behind the scenes, but I'll bet do you have the text of the Eucharist?
I don't have it in front of me, but people can Google it. It's awesome.
It's so long. They know, say that know, it's beautiful.
But it's so long.
They say they don't use it because it's so long. It's like an extra 90 seconds on the knees. As we know, they're really concerned about our knee health. What's the adjectival for knee? That would be hilarious. It's a great meme.
Your genu, what would it be? I don't know.
Your genuflectorial muscles.
Yes, like exactly. Glutes. Yeah.
They're really, these lib priests that have stolen into the priesthood are more concerned about your knee health. You got a lot of middle-aged guys that are concerned about the kid's back health, right? Because you throw out your lower back, it can give you real problems. No one's as concerned about your knee health as a liberal Novus Ordo priest, right? Don't look.
Right.
You know, 9 out of 10 Americans have undiagnosed knee problems. So do not kneel. Do not kneel. They hate it.
Yesterday, someone on Twitter said the problem with, I don't know, he didn't say you people, but he said, why would you impose kneeling at a rail for the Eucharist? I'm old and I have bad knees. He used the word impose. And I think maybe, I don't know what, but the idea was you're imposing this on me and you're excluding me from the Eucharist.
Wow.
That's so not true because I see people in wheelchairs and walkers and limping going up to the altar rail all the time. And do they kneel? No, they don't. No one judges them. No one's like, cares? That old lady in a wheelchair just received communion sitting down in her wheelchair.
Right.
No one cares because she's an old lady in a wheelchair. Or like your daughter, if she's in a wheelchair and she's a young child, no one's like, that handicapped child didn't kneel at the rail. What's going on at this church? But they want
it. The liberal narrative is a cudgel. Yes. It's and that's all it is. It's a crowbar. So they want all of us not to be able to kneel based on the 1%. I mean, Abby's not typical. People in wheelchairs are not typical. And no one even notices because everyone at a real kneeling altar rail are so caught up in what they're doing. The last thing they care about is someone that goes up and just doesn't.
That's right. And I've seen old people, they just come to the rail and they stand there. And Father leans out an extra 5 inches and place the host on their tongue.
Right.
I saw a lady last week. She was probably in her late 40s. She had a knee brace on. She did the same thing.
Right.
Cause I'm now aware of it. Cause I'm thinking all these, progressives are like, you guys are making people with knee problems get on their knees or you're excommunicating them. No, we're not.
It's so
dumb.
You know what it's like? It's like saying if you force legislatively the presentation of the driver's license to vote, that you're disenfranchising I mean, you're actually keeping non-enfranchised people that shouldn't be voting, which is really what they object to here in the state of California. But it means that how am I disenfranchising someone? Like, what if somebody lost their ID? It's like, well, you have to go get a new one before you vote. Same thing. It's like, but no one cares about that. And everyone knows there's a workaround for the exception. You make a rule based around the majority, not the exception makes bad law. It's the first thing they teach you in law school. Like, you don't make the whole rule for the minority.
Yes.
Right. You just bend the rules for the minority and you say, well, of course that wheelchair guy is not going to get off and kneel. Like, who gives a damn?
Yeah. No, and if it's extreme, I've even seen it where you have handicapped children who are in like a bigger wheelchair. I don't know what you would call it. You know, the priest comes out of the altar rail a little bit and communicates the person.
Of course.
And it's touching too. Sometimes I've seen like a parent, like if the child can't make the sign of the cross, the kid will receive, even the parent will like make the sign of the cross over the kid. It's awesome.
Well, that's what I'll be doing for Abby.
Yeah, it's really cool.
She's going to go through it soon. Yeah, we waited. She's going to go through it with Maggie. It's because she's a little older.
For first communion?
Teach her a little more. She's going to do it this spring. And it's like, I know I'm going to be, until she gets the hang of it, doing the sign of the cross every time or Steph.
It's awesome. So,
yeah.
And, you know, the Eucharistic prayer, too, the old legend is, and it's actually a true legend, is it was written in a tavern or at a restaurant. Here's the quote. This is regarding, when I say Bouillet, I mean Louis Bouillet, who is not that great a guy, just so you know, when it comes to theology and liturgy, even though a lot of conservatives like him. It was Louis Bouillet who had to remedy in extremis a horrible formulation of the new Eucharistic prayer too, from which Bugnini even wanted to delete the Sanctus, the Holy, Holy, Holy.
Crazy.
It was he who had to rewrite the text of the new canon, Eucharistic Prayer 2, that is read in masses today, one evening on the table of a trattoria,
yeah,
in Trastevere, together with the Benedictine liturgist Bernard Botte, with the tormenting thought that everything had to be consigned the following morning, end quote. So this is not natural liturgical development that happens over centuries, like in the Roman Rite. This is a couple dudes at a restaurant in Trastevere with a sheet of paper or a napkin, like a, you know, college freshman cramming a paper that
Let's
has
be
to
honest,
be
like Eminem writing a rap on a burger joint napkin,
spitting rhymes,
spitting nuggets. That's what, and this is a famous Bouillet story about.
Yeah.
And they defend against this story, not by saying that that's not true, that didn't happen. They just say, they're having a conversation over a bite to eat about an ancient prayer. And, you know, it's really well tethered to the historicity of the prayer. And you guys just made fools out of yourselves for trying to make fun of writing Eucharistic prayer too on a napkin. It's like, no, we did it.
Yeah,
they're being far too flippant with it.
They say it's the Eucharistic prayer of Hippolytus.
Hippolytus.
We don't know if Hippolytus, it's spurious. We don't know if Hippolytus wrote it.
Questionable origin. Right.
B, if you actually go and get the prayer of Hippolytus translated into English and put it up next to Eucharistic Prayer 2. It's way different, folks. They edited it, chopped parts out, deleted parts.
It's not even recognizable.
Some people even say that the Eucharistic prayer of Hippolytus is quasi-Aryan because the language of Christ may be a little bit lower.
I've heard that.
So there's problems. A, we don't know who wrote it. B, we don't know if it goes to St. Hippolytus. C, the text itself is theologically sketchy. And D, they change the text, so it's not the same prayer. It's the prayer on the napkin at Trastevere. And this is the prayer that everybody hears Sunday after Sunday. It's for sure at every daily mass in the Novus Ordo. Eucharistic prayer too. I know a really funny priest who was like, he doesn't do the Eucharistic prayer too. He said, I haven't dropped a deuce in a year, by which he meant Eucharistic prayer too. So that's the second one. Of course, there's Eucharistic Prayer 3 and 4. You hardly ever hear those. Mainly what you hear is Eucharistic Prayer 2, not because it's better, but because it's the shortest. It's the fast food Eucharistic Prayer.
But maybe too much fast food is keeping that priest from dropping the number.
The Eucharistic prayer number 2.
You're probably super concerned for him, by the way. You're like, a year?
You haven't dropped the deuce in the year.
I've heard.
He's like, no, dude. I mean, Eucharistic prayer. Yeah, Eucharistic prayer 2.
So have you ever heard corroboration of that famous old, I've heard corroboration of the Bouyer story about the writing on the napkin. Have you ever heard corroboration that Bunini wanted to get rid of the Sanctus? Because I've never heard that corroborated by anyone else.
I don't have the text in front of me, but I think it's Bouyer who says this.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, yeah. And for everyone who's new to all this, Bunini was this radical liturgist who was hired by Pius XII, kept on by John the 23rd, Paul the 6th. He wrecked the liturgy. He's the guy.
Wait, he was running the liturgy. He was running communio. Concilium, right? He was put in charge by Paul the 6th.
And you know, a lot of traditionally minded Catholics, they're not really happy with the 1962 Holy Week, because in 1955 Bugnini redid the Holy Week. And it's kind of like crypto novus ordo. For example, the presider's chair appears in 1955 during Easter or Holy Week. So Palm Sunday to Easter. Prayers are now being said at the chair, not at the altar. And there's a bunch of other differences, too. So you can see that Bugnini sort of testing the waters and seeing if he can mitigate some of the sacerdotal priestly action in the 1955 Holy Week under Pius XII. They do it. It works. And so when the Second Vatican Council happens, they're like, well, hey, what we did to Holy Week, let's do for the whole year, but even more so. So the priest is no longer up at the altar praying the collect and the prayers and all. He's over at his presider's chair. Right. So all that started happening in 1955. And that's why, you know, if you go to a fraternity parish or even SSPX and all that, the big debate is, well, we're doing the 1962 liturgy, but baptized into that is the 1955 Bugnini Holy Week. So what do we do?
We don't like that.
We don't like that. Yeah, we don't like that.
Also, Bunini, just as a side note, this is not, this is everywhere corroborated, was all but proven to have been an active Freemason.
Yes. Active participation.
Active participation in Freemasonry. People point out all the Freemasonic elements of the Novus Ordo. We're getting a little tinfoil hattier than usual, but this is well documented. Paul the Sixth, allegedly, right? Ratzinger went forward and told Paul the Sixth, "Look on Concilium here," which was the little sort of it's like a congressional subcommittee charged with taking Sacrosanctum Concilium, the Vatican document on the liturgy, and translating it into the Missal of Paul the Sixth. But allegedly, Ratzinger went forward to Paul VI and he said, look, this Bunini guy is crazy. He's going off the rails. He wants to get rid of the Sanctus, apparently, or whatever. I don't know exactly what he said, but he's going wild. And Paul VI said, no, this is my guy. I'm sticking with him. He's basically the architect of the Novus Ordo. And so Ratzinger, together with Louis Bouyer and I guess even Balthazar, leave and they go form Communio, which is like the gayest title you could come up with for a group of dudes, but they leave in protest. And then, you know, the Missal of Paul the Sixth is released late 1969. And then not 2.5 years later, Paul the Sixth ends up admitting that the smoke of Satan has entered through some orifice. Then he says, no, through a specific orifice.
Right. But doesn't say the
fissure.
Yeah,
the divine sanctuary, and a couple months after that, he essentially exiles Bunini papal nuncio to Iran or something. And it was after many cardinals alleged that they caught him with materials from Freemasonry. And this is the guy that wrote the Novus Ordo. People, the puzzle pieces connect. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, and you know Bugnini's he's on paper. Just he shows photos of before and afters of sanctuaries, and he's the guy who loves it when the statues are taken out, whitewashed. And one of the things Bugnini loved was the removal of the tabernacle from the sanctuary. He thought that was essential to the new liturgy.
What does that sound like? Yeah.
With
the tabernacle needing to be essential to the new liturgy. That is the liturgy. That's crazy. Yeah,
the whole idea is why are all of our churches, the tabernacles in another room? Bunini, he's the guy who said, look, you can't have the Eucharist in a box because then people are going to focus on that and not the community. So get the box out of there. That's Bunini, folks.
It's all right. Wild.
I know.
It's wild.
All right, one more word, and we got to shut it down here. Liturgical restoration, which we've kind of already covered. It's the idea, beginning in the 50s, Jungmann was really into this, that we need to restore the ancient liturgy. So Jungmann would say, hey, we did this this archaeology, and we found this church, and the altar was off the wall. So obviously, the priest was facing the people. Therefore, we need to restore versus populum, the priest facing the people. Well, we learned that that's not true. The Byzantines, all the Eastern churches have freestanding altars, and the priest has his back to the people ad orientem. So just because an altar is off the wall doesn't mean that he has to stand to the people. So it's a lie. Right. But they restored the ancient practice of facing the people for Mass, which was not true. Another one is they restored the offertory procession. We need a family to carry the bread and wine up to the priest, up to the sanctuary.
Right. Yeah, the trick is they're finding anything that might have once been aberrant or desecratory that they want to do, any historical instance.
Yes.
And saying, and I've been in this argument recently again with very conservative Catholics who are kind of trying to defend it. No, it was restorational or restorative. No. I mean, just because one guy in the history of the liturgy has one priest say snapped bubble gum as he said the divine sacrifice of the Mass doesn't mean that it's okay to do. No, but it's restorative. So now every priest should have bubblicious or whatever.
I know.
That's what they're doing. It's rhetoric.
Or at the extreme cases, this happened on Twitter again a couple of weeks ago, or maybe it was a week ago. I was talking about the novelty of lay people touching the Eucharist, how this is an aberration in the East and in the West. And somebody says, well, what about St. Tarsicius? Here, he was a young man, a layman who was bringing the Eucharist to Christian Catholics who were in prison. And he got stoned. And instead of turning over the Eucharist, he sacrificed himself and he died. He's a martyr, a young martyr. And I said, well, A, he was ordained as an acolyte. So he was in minor orders. So he is a cleric. B, it was a time of persecution. C, he was taking the Eucharist to Catholics in prison secretly. They couldn't attend Mass. It's kind of different than 2019 in America, where everyone in the church is coming up and handling the Eucharist. Wouldn't you agree?
Right.
But they want to take that example and universalize it.
Right.
He wasn't a priest and he touched the Eucharist. Yeah, it's kind of a different situation.
We're obviously a different situation.
Yeah.
And they know it. And they know it. That's the thing.
They're like, well, but a lay guy touched the Eucharist. I know it's an extreme situation. I would hope that if I were in prison awaiting martyrdom, that someone, even an acolyte, would bring me the Eucharist one last time. And I wouldn't be like, wait, I can't receive. You're not a priest. It's a different situation.
Right.
For sure. You know, the other one is to say, well, if you go back and, you know, you go to St. Cyril, he talks about making your hands as a throne for God.
That's right.
If you keep reading that quote, he says, and then once you receive it, touch it to your eyes, touch it to your mouth, your ears, your nose. And then when you receive the blood, take it and touch your eyes and your ears with it. So that's the full quote, which makes the quote spurious. And they want to restore the communion on the hand, but they don't want to restore rubbing the Eucharist all over your face, which is what the full quote says.
Right.
So we as Catholics just say, that quote's a little sketchy. It's off the table. You can't use it. But they won't do that. They won't do that. They want to restore what is progressive or what looks progressive, even if they make up stuff like Eucharistic prayer, too.
Yeah, lots of the patristics got stuff really, really wrong. Look at Origen, everything that all of the patristics, even Thomas Aquinas had little peccadillos, and he's
the master
doctor. He's the master doctor, the angelic doctor, and even he got little things here and there wrong. I'm not going to point them out because they're so little, but lots of the patristics got stuff really wrong. So that it's not a prima facie case of Origen did it, therefore we should do it anyway, even if the Tale of Jean Novelle, which I never trusted their motives for being new anything. New is always a four-letter word in liturgy or anything in the church in my house. But even if their motives were pure, which I don't even believe, they still could have gotten it wrong. They could have wrongly sought wisdom from the past.
That's right. That's right. And you have guys, I can't remember which Cappadocian it is. It's either Basil Gregory Nyssa or Gregory Nazianzus. I can't remember right now. But he grants that there's communion in the hand. He's observed it. But he says it's an abuse. People shouldn't be touching it. But so here's a guy in the 300s who has observed communion in the hand. So was communion in the hand going on in the 300s? Yes, we have a firsthand witness of it. But then he says this should not be done.
That's good.
So, yes, it was going on, but the really awesome bishops and saints were like, not a good idea.
Right.
It could be dropped. It could be stolen. It could be desecrated. Let's not do it.
Right.
Other ones that they restore is the passing of the peace. We need to restore the ancient custom of passing of the peace in Mass by having people shake hands with one another. What?
Right.
No, that never happened ever in 2,000 years.
It's so lame. It's so lame.
There weren't any Christians in Syria in the 9th century or in Rome in the 3rd century or 15th century who at the passing of the peace stood up and shook each other's hands.
So lame.
I know. Again,
another thing, even the young adults know, they like do it jokingly, you know, making fun of it. It's so corny and stilted. Yeah. 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 Peace, bro. Yeah. Yeah. But they're doing it like,
There's always kindness too. It's like, oh, you have a beautiful family, peace, you know, or so glad you're here. You got to add in some more stuff too, which is, it's kind. It's all well-intentioned. It's just not the right context.
Good. It is well-intentioned, but it's like, yeah, thanks. Sorry. My token like compliment bank just ran dry. When they say like, you have a beautiful family, I'm thanks. You have a beautiful car, I think.
Yeah.
Even though I can't see it.
Nice
here.
Necklace. I mean,
your jacket is so great.
And the crazy thing about it is the Eucharist is confected on the altar at that moment.
That's true.
And we're glad handing. It's kind of like, what? It's almost like Bugnini saying, we got the tabernacle out of the church. Thank goodness. Bugnini saying, but now we have the Eucharist back on the altar. Distraction. Have people shake hands.
That's actually probably what it was. I'd bet you dollars to donuts.
Yep. Yep. So what else we got on there? We got lay ministers of communion, but we've talked about that before.
Yeah. Extraordinary ministers versus they knew, you know,
which are only supposed to be an exception.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's what extraordinary means. Yeah. How about we make extraordinary ministers as much a rarity as, say, the extraordinary form of the Mass, which should be ordinary. Right.
Or
the extraordinary form Eucharistic of the Mass prayer is not one to be seen. Or Eucharistic prayer one. Those are extraordinary.
Right.
Insofar as you never see them. How about extraordinary ministers only come out from their wherever all the liberal ex nuns hang out or whoever does this parish to parish once a year or something. We can just get it out of the way then and I'll be at the Latin Mass that week anyway. How about something like that? But it's every week and everyone just, if there weren't ministers, lay ministers, then people would not know what to do.
Right.
That's how ordinary it is.
And lay minister is a contradiction of terms.
It is.
Lay minister, what? Doesn't make any sense.
It's funny.
And you'll go to a daily Mass and there'll be, you know, 45 people there for daily Mass and you've got 5 EMs. Or lay minister, you're like, what? Are we like in such a rush?
Right.
And setting up the EMs, and they have to get their Purell pump, they pump their hands, and they got to come up front, they've all got to be communicated. That takes a long time.
It does.
If the priest just walked down and started communicating people, we got to get Dude Perfect. We got to do a Dude Perfect show where we time it.
Didn't someone say they timed it? Someone was writing that they timed it both ways. I don't think it was that scientific, but they said it's way quicker to do.
To do which way?
The old way.
Yeah.
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 That doesn't surprise
rails.
Me.
Of course, it's fast on the rails.
Yeah.
Typewriter.
Yep.
It's do it. Yeah. I'm this stuff makes me so mad. Like, we'll be joking about it during the shows, and I'm like, it's because no one wants to see someone getting grumpy about it. But then I'll notice some, particularly when we do the liturgical shows, and I'll be like, just like bristly about it, like later in the morning. I'm like, this, it really is, from a diabolic point of view, a well laid plan, a well conceived plan to attack. And look, they just, it makes me mad, and it makes me struggle with Caritas. Yes. When the next time I go to Mass, it'll be tomorrow.
Yep.
The next time I go to Mass and I see all these, you know, the Leninist term for this is useful idiots just lapping it up,
yeah.
like not understand. It's so obvious once you realize even a little bit about what's going on, what they did, these Jacobins to yeah. the liturgy, that it's like, how are these people not seeing it? I always detected this as a middle school kid, as a fifth grader. And it's like, then you learn a little bit of the history and you pull on that thread and it's really obvious. Anyway, I don't want to get, I don't like getting grumpy after these shows because I enjoy right. doing the shows, but it's, right. it's very hard to bear.
Yes. Well, anyway. There's some buzzwords, Novus Ordo, Vatican II.
To be grumpy about.
Buzzword. Yeah. And I think this was a good show, Tim, because we weren't just looking at the buzzwords and showing that they're dumb. We actually showed that there's a lot of theology packed into the buzzwords. I think even more than our previous show where we looked at just post-Vatican II buzzwords. There's more at stake here in the liturgical buzzwords, like worship right. space and presider. There's a lot more, I think, pernicious theology embedded in this element. You know,
the pernicious theology is arguably more crucial to the project. I maybe it's inarguable, is more crucial yeah. to the project.
Yeah. And again, people, we're not, everyone's going to say, they're going to say, yeah, but what about the really reverent Novus Ordo?
The unicorn,
the famous unicorn, Novus Ordo. And even if I granted you the most awesome Ad Orientem Novus Ordo and all that textual side by side, for example, the offertory prayers, you know, the work of human hands, you know, which earth is given and human hands are prepared. Compare that to what you see in the 1962 Missal at the offertory. Tell me yeah. that's the same level of reverence and theology. With the yeah. prayer said by the priest to God.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not just about the vestments. It's not just about the altar and the tabernacle and all that. It's about what the priest says to God in the liturgy. It's a big deal. So
yeah.
if you've never been to a Latin Mass, go check it out. It's kind of yeah. like beer. You may not like it the first time you taste it. That's okay. Just go back again. Give yourself at least, I always say at least four times.
Yeah.
You got to give yourself at least four times to start getting it, and then probably 6 months of it to be habituated, where it's kind of like riding a bike. And you
kind
of
have to have a missal. You have to bring a missal with you, mm-hmm. unlike the Novus Ordo, which really eliminates the need for a missal because of all the participation. Got to get that missal, and it'll make
a big difference.
It makes a big difference in a well, I won't say real Mass. People go nuts, but right. do it.
Yeah. And, you know, I have 8 kids at Mass with me, so I don't often crack this. Yeah. But if you're going to go to Latin Mass, you need one. Oh, by the way, I put up a post yesterday, Tim, called Dr. Marshall's Happy Meal. And it's a bunch of books.
Yeah.
I don't know why yeah. I call it the Happy Meal. I was like, this is a meal. People need this feast. It'll make them yeah. happy if they eat this. So I put up like 10 books that you need. It's like Catechism of the Council of Trent, a Dewey Rheims Bible, like all this like traditional Catholic stuff to get you back to the sources. And there's 2 options on there on a Latin Mass missal. So just Google my name, Dr. Marshall, traditional books, or Happy Meal, as I called it. And you can get all the links there and get those books. So everybody, thanks yeah. for watching. Pray the rosary. If you want to dare, pray that rosary at Mass.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
Six days a week away from Mass, and then get your 7th day rosary in at Mass, like
that's
a
right.
rebel.
That's right. Pray like the rosary every day. As we say, if you're watching TNT, you're watching these shows, but you're not praying the rosary every day, you're not on the team. You got to have the weapon.
16 minutes to pray that weapon. Just take the extra 16 minutes. Yeah. Even if you need to cut out 16 minutes of your TNT time.
That's right.
Do that, because it's incredibly valuable, and it'll help you in all your endeavors.
Amen. All right, so hit that subscribe button, hit the bell, like this video, tell your friends, share it on Twitter, follow us on Twitter, and be the Maccabee, be salty. Signing out.
Hey, this is Dr. Taylor Marshall. I'm leading a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, and I would like to invite you. This pilgrimage is unique because it's based on the daily mass in the extraordinary form. And our chaplain is the well-known preacher, Father John Hallwell. I'll also be giving teachings from my book, The Crucified Rabbi, about how Christ and the Catholic Church fulfills the Old Testament. We'll also be renewing our vows at the Jordan River, our marriage vows at Cana, and having mass at all the sacred sites, including the Holy Sepulcher of our Lord. 2019 is considered to be one of the safest times to travel to the Holy Land, but space is limited. So please sign up at pilgrimages.com/Taylor Marshall, and I'll send you a free signed copy of my book, The Crucified Rabbi, to prepare you for this once-in-a-lifetime pilgrimage. I look forward to meeting in the Holy Land and praying with you. Till then, God bless.